the interest.
I call this meeting of the House Ways and Means Committee to order, and note for the record that a quorum is present. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here timely so we could get started, which is probably quite a feat being how late, and I think everyone's pretty tired. So thank you, everybody, for getting here so we could get going right away. The first order of business is the approval of the minutes from Tuesday, April 18, 2023. Vice Chair Edelson, can I get a motion for approval?
That's my motion, Madam Chair.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. And the first bill on the calendar, well, let me just quick walk through. We're going to do the Human Services Budget Bill, and we'll send that out, or we will take action on that as its own bill, and then we will take up the Judiciary Budget Bill. We'll lay it over, and then we'll take up the Public Safety Bill, and then we'll merge the Judiciary after we process that bill. So the first bill is House Senate File 2934, Representative Knorr, the Human Services Budget Bill. So welcome to the table there, Representative Knorr. And with that, Representative Knorr moves that Senate File 2934 be placed on the General Register. And Representative Knorr, we're going to do a delete everything. So I will make a motion on your behalf that Representative Knorr moves to delete everything after the enacting clause and insert the language from House File 2847, the first engrossment. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the House language has been adopted. And so we have the A-17 amendment. We'll move that first to get it in the shape you'd like. So Representative Knorr moves the A-17 amendment. And please describe your amendment, Representative Knorr.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. The A-17 amendment has got some technical fixes. And on line 1.6, we're moving the qualified professionals to do supervisory duties using Zoom or what do you call two-way systems online, virtual systems. And then we are also making some changes to the grant capacity for rural underserved communities under 2.5. We are making some changes to the PACE program, which is on 3.10. We are also making some minor additions to the OPIP. We're deleting the sanctions in OPIP. We're also including waiver for certain providers and also putting the sunset for the OPIP. Madam Chair, the rest is fixing some other technical issues within the bill.
Any discussion to the A-17 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A-17 amendment is adopted. Let's do the A-18 now, too, and that way we're just done with all the amendments. So the A-18 is the grant management language that's been going on all the budget bills. So with that, Representative Knorr moves the A-18 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, this is an amazing bill. Today is a good day because we're talking about providing care to those who need the most, taking care of the most vulnerable members in our communities. This is a labor of love, compassion, and care. First of all, I wanted to thank the staff, the nonpartisan staff who are behind me who have done an amazing job, to some of our staff in the DFL and also in the GOP, and also to the department for the amazing work we've done with this bill. Madam Chair and members, this is for Dennis, who lost his life because he could not find a PCA. This is for Mary, who came before us and said, please remember us. You should listen to your seniors, and we did listen to Mary. Madam Speaker, Madam Chair, this is for Stacy from New Orleans and Autumnville when we're taking care of people who are in ICFDD. The COVID-19 pandemic highlighted the urgent need to ensure that all Minnesotans have the option to receive quality long-term care in a setting that meets their needs and preference. And the vast majority of Minnesotans prefer to receive such care and support at home. This bill is a generational investment in long-term care. It's a historic investment. It's about caring for our loved ones and making the smart economic choices for families and communities. This bill is centered on direct support professionals, a majority of whom are women and BIPOC, who earn a wage of $13 per hour with few or no benefits while providing compassionate and life-sustaining care. This results in exceptionally high annual turnover rates, an estimate of 60%. Madam Chair and members, Minnesota is currently experiencing unprecedented workforce shortage in the long-term care, with about 52,000 vacancies. This bill will strengthen the caregiving workforce and improve quality of life for families and boost economic security for direct support professionals by creating good-paying jobs to make it possible for families and workers alike to thrive economically. Madam Chair and members, we are in the midst of caregiving crisis worsened by the COVID-19 pandemic. Seniors and people with disabilities are struggling to find an affordable care, forcing families to make difficult decisions like leaving the workforce in order to care for a loved one. This bill brings us closer towards ensuring that no one must wait to get care that they deserve, and no direct care worker or professional has to live below the poverty line to provide this care. This bill will increase payment rates, promote recruitment and retention of direct support professionals. It increases wages and creates workforce incentives and training opportunities. Let me walk you through it in the bill based on the finances we have. Sorry about that, Madam Chair. We start with investment, significant investment in PCA and Community First Service and Support, CFSS, which will be the new PCA program. This is an investment unlike any other time. This bill, we are investing $1.3 billion in fiscal year 24 and 25, and $1.55 billion in 26 and 27. For the PCA, we have $889,487,000. This is an increase of payment from $15.25 under the choice program to $20 in 2025. In 2024, the increase is at $19 an hour. Madam Chair and members, we are also creating career ladders within the PCA program or CFSS by ensuring that those who work in the industry have got an opportunity to stay and have steps to climb so they can see their income is going up. We start with those who have worked for 6 months by increasing in 2025 by 50 cents. And if someone has worked for more than 5 years in the industry, they'll be receiving $22.50. Madam Chair and members, we are increasing the rates for the DWRS and ICFDD by investing in DWRS at $264 million and $692,000. And the ICFDD, we're investing $13 million and $93,000. Madam Chair and members, I talked about the significant investment and listening to Mary. She talked about the services that they receive in assisted living. We have listened to you, Mary, and we're investing $874 million and $304,000 in the elderly waiver program. This has never happened before. Madam Chair and members, we are also increasing the rates for the home and community-based services by $96 million and $665,000. We are also investing in various other programs, particularly in workforce development, by investing $84,643,000. Likewise, we're increasing the workforce participation for people with disabilities by eliminating the sub-minimum wage. Madam Speaker and members, unfortunately, more Minnesotans are left out, especially those individuals with disabilities, with some of them receiving 7 cents an hour. 7 cents an hour. because of the 14C exception that people are using. Minnesota is the highest in any other place in the country with more people who are doing the subminimum wage. It's time. It's overdue that we eliminate the subminimum wage in the state of Minnesota. We're also providing an off-ramp by investing $19,324,000 for those agencies who are using the subminimum wage. Madam Chair and members, there are many great items in this bill when it comes to eliminating the subminimum wage. We are also supporting the transition of the customized living settings who are now in assisted living, transitioning to a different model. Communities who have come to us and told us about the change will cost them some significant harm. So we are investing close to $10 million for them to transition to community residential settings. Madam Chair and members, we are also investing in the Vulnerable Adults Redesign Program by investing $50 million. We also are doing a major investment when it comes to addressing the significant opioid crisis that we are facing of $85,464,000. Let me pause on that. We have seen the crisis that has taken many lives in our state and across different communities. It's time that we end this crisis. We're removing the sunset on ART because there's no time to wait. This crisis needs significant investment. We're increasing the membership number for the ORC, which is the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, by including the tribal government. We're also creating some major changes when it comes to informing communities of Bad Batch by creating an Amber Alert process, by getting a text. They'll get a text message to inform them there's a problem that we need to fix. We're also increasing the public awareness when it comes to reducing harm. Madam Chair and members, we are also investing $24 million to address the AIDS crisis that we're facing, especially in the Twin Cities and Duluth area. We have seen an increase of 8%, and there's a cliff on the federal resources that we're receiving. I know there are many great things in this bill. It can take me the whole day to explain it. But let me put it this way. This is about time. This is an overdue. This is about those who need the most. I know some folks will be talking about the nursing homes, but let me explain it. We have over $10 million for the critical access nursing facility, which provides 15 nursing homes in greater Minnesota, the resource that they need to keep people within a short distance from their home. That's a huge investment for the nursing homes in greater Minnesota. That will take care of 500 individuals in those nursing homes. Likewise, I think we all know that the value-based reimbursement that was instituted in January 1 in 2016, we understand many people may not see it, but that investment is baked in the system that has shown that 83% increase since the inception of the VBI program. That's an average of 10% increase per year. Likewise, Madam Speaker and Madam Chair and members, this is something that we've been looking through to make sure that they don't shut down their doors, but they have access to workers. We understand the biggest challenge in the industry is workforce shortage. We understand the biggest challenge is to maintain because of the inflation and several other things that have been happening in the industry. But believe it, that we have an $853 million already baked in the system for the next 4 years for the nursing home facilities. We're not forgetting about anyone. This bill encompasses everyone in the long-term care industry. Madam Chair and members, I stand ready to answer any questions that the members may have.
Thank you, Representative Knorr, for presenting your very comprehensive bill and all of your work putting that together. I know that the human services and health world is no easy feat to put together bills this complex, and so thank you for that. We'll go to discussion. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Knorr, you ended up on the nursing home things, and yes, we do have questions. And confused by the numbers. Our research shows that we're over 50 nursing home beds short just by what is placed on layaway because we don't have the people to man the beds. Speaking from firsthand experience, one of my best friend's mother tried to get into a nursing home last month. One of the 11,000 people that were turned away from a nursing home last month because there's no beds. We've got the equivalent of 50 nursing homes that are shut down in this state due to layaways because they don't have staffing, and our solution is to staff 15. Is that the number that I'm hearing, Representative Norr?
Representative Norr.
Madam Chair, members, I think I've had 11,000 people have been turned away from nursing homes. Just wanted to correct the record. There isn't 11,000 people turned away from nursing homes. If you look at the data that is being provided, it includes the assisted living. And when you look at this bill, there's never been an investment in elderly waiver like we did. $864 million. Those are workers, direct service workers, who are receiving $13. We're just bringing them up to be paid $17 an hour. Likewise, I think the data is duplicated in many ways. And when we talk about the baked-in investment of $853 million, it's in the VBR program. The workforce shortage is impacting the entire industry in the state. We have got almost close to 200,000 job openings. 200,000. And in the healthcare industry, we are seeing almost 53,000 workforce shortage. We've got a crisis. And we better find solutions. And I think that is what we're doing in this bill, by creating opportunity for those workers to enter in the industry from high school to bringing new people into this industry so that we care for those who need the most. And I think that is the biggest challenge we're seeing in the industry rather than the investment of resources, which I've just talked about, that it's already in there.
Representative Vatney.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Norr. And I can't imagine this is an easy bill to put together. I was trying to think about what it would be like to have a $20 billion budget surplus and have to put together the human services portion of the state budget. You think about how in education people graduate from education. They go on and do other things. Even transportation, we don't always use transportation, but we're always human. And so I'm sure if you were given the target of $20 billion, you could have found ways to spend that and still have requests beyond that, because that's just the nature of the budget that we have here. And largely, what you have been able to provide with the target that you were given, this is a bill that has a lot of good things in there. And I think that the one point you're going to hear from us continually on this is the what's missing from the bill, and that is the lack of funding for nursing homes. And so you talked first about the 15 nursing homes that are going to be helped with this. I have 12 nursing homes in my district, and so I don't know where the other three nursing homes are going to be helped, but I can't wait to see those 12 of mine get helped out in there. You also had mentioned that you're working to make sure that the doors don't shut on our nursing homes. At the same time, the Department of Health and the Departments of Human Services are holding webinars to help nursing homes figure out how to shut their doors. The $853 million is that we hear bandied about, that is based on four-year forecasts, and that includes the state and federal dollars. That's the number that the Department of Human Services keeps telling us, but that's state and federal dollars. The request that came from the industry is only from the state dollars, and that's based on the forecast that we have coming up over the next 4 years. And so if you look back over the last 4 years and how those forecasts went, 4 years ago we could have said, well, in the next 4 years, the nursing home should be getting $597 million. And when we actually got to the point we're at today, they got $404 million. Which is $193 million off. And so if we're going to say that they're getting $853 million over the next 4 years, we also have to say, based on that same logic, that they had a $193 million cut over the last 4 years. And so there's reason to be concerned with the logic that is used from the Department of Human Services on saying forecasted dollars are increases that we have here. Now, the industry did get a rate increase at the beginning of this year, and that dealt with the costs that they had during the 29th from October of 2019 through September of 2020. And everyone knows that the world was an incredibly different place in October of 2019 through September of 2020. And a lot of changes that were short term and expenses that were short term were placed on nursing homes, and there are long term ramifications that they're still dealing with. But the increases that they're seeing today are still not reflective of the world we live in today. And it contributes to this bottleneck. And as the chief author of the value-based reimbursement bill, now 7 years ago and a full head of hair ago, it was not a perfect plan, but it got us off of the system that was 30 years of patchwork. And there was still more work to do, and regrettably, I didn't continue on with that work as diligently as I should have, because maybe we could have prevented what we are seeing in front of us today, where we think there's more money going in to support the system than what there is. And what we're seeing today, we talk about the workforce shortage and how all of healthcare has a workforce shortage. This is the head of the bottleneck, the fact that we can't have nursing homes operating at the level that they should be operating at. Hospitals need more beds opened up in their own facilities, and they can do that by passing patients along who are ready for that skilled level of nursing care. But the nursing homes can't take those people because they're understaffed, and so they miss that revenue opportunity. It's worth pointing out at this point, too, that the nursing home industry is one of the few in the state that is controlled both on the revenue side and the expense side of the ledger on there. And so they miss that opportunity from being able to take people into the system that they have. But to try and make up for that, the nursing homes then hire contract nurses. And, of course, we know contract nurses are going to be at a more expensive rate than what hiring someone straight out is going to be for that. And the unfortunate thing that we missed in the value-based reimbursement is that the contract nurses get put into the non-cost basis part of their reports, and so they don't get reimbursed for the full extent of what it costs to keep their doors open, even if it is keeping their doors open with contract nurses, and that also causes them to miss revenue. And so that requires them to close more beds and take fewer admissions because they can't afford it, because they're spending more on the contract nurses, but they have to have the contract nurses to keep the beds that they do have open. And as we see this vicious circle continue to go on the decline, we've seen 2,500 beds close since the October 2019 cost report that they're now being reimbursed on for that. And so I think that not Representative Knorr, with the bill he has here, I don't think that there was a target that effectually recognized this. I don't think that the department is being the most forthright in the way that they're presenting the information to the legislature on what the actual cost of doing services in this state are and what they're actually trying to do with nursing homes. And for that reason, members, I have more questions and hope that there are opportunities still this session to try and fill in what is being missed here, and we'll be voting no today for that reason.
Further discussion? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, Chair Knorr, I just want to express my appreciation for all your work on this bill. I do think it's an amazing bill and an amazing opportunity to improve a lot of lives and to address some of the most difficult challenges that we've been hearing about over the years. And I think it's never going to be possible to meet all needs. It just never will, not in this space and not in any of the spaces that we work in. And so I think this is a just an amazing achievement. You know, talking about the nursing homes, it's a confusing area. And I think people who don't work in the area, when we say value-based reimbursement, I don't think most people would even know what that means. I mean, I know in my other lives, I've had to explain that to people a number of times. And I wonder if I could just ask you to kind of give the explanation that you would give to somebody who knows nothing about this area of how nursing homes get paid. Would you mind if you could do that?
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair and Chair Liebling, I think I will not do justice to explain the VBI process, but we do have an expert here who can help us and to be able to explain so people understand how the VBI process works, if that works, Madam Chair.
Representative Noor, we certainly can do that. Otherwise, do you just want to do a Representative Liebling? Were you asking for kind of just a general what we would say, not an expert, I think is
yeah.
what you might be getting at? So Representative Noor, do you just want to do that? And we can bring down the department too, but Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Noor, yeah, I'm kind of, well, let me just, you know, if I could, let me just tell you sort of what I tell people. I mean, just on the most simple level. And then you just tell me if it's correct, or maybe your expert can just tell me if I'm sort of misstating it, because I'm really just looking for, you know, like, as the chair says, not what the experts would say and not the details, but just, you know, that this is one area where the facilities report their costs, and then subject to some limits, the costs are then paid, whatever their costs were, get paid to them later on. And there is a gap because there's a lot of, you know, analysis and figuring out that has to go on. But they basically get paid for their costs. And that's really different than a lot of other things that we fund. I really appreciate Representative Schumacher's kind of history on this a little bit. I'm not sure when the bill was passed that I fully understood what it did, but I do know that because of the way nursing homes are reimbursed, that the state forecast projects forward what they would expect to get, and they don't have to, you know, they will continue to get paid and continue to get increases without ever coming to the legislature again. So you don't have to see it on a spreadsheet that it's that they're getting more money. And I think that said, it doesn't say that it's perfect. It doesn't say that it's enough. It doesn't say that they don't have challenges. But when we look across the whole system, they have sort of a special position in that way. And I think your bill really acknowledges that and addresses it. I did want to ask one other little question about this, and maybe your expert can help it just a bit. But there was some controversy, I would say, maybe 2 years ago when we did this bill, and maybe it was 4 years ago now, when we tried to make a change in the value-based reimbursement formula because there's a piece in there that's supposed to be for quality. When this was put together, there was a quality measure. And if the homes hit that quality measure, they would get extra money. And as it turns out, that quality measure was set too low, so basically everybody hit the quality measure. And when we tried to readjust that quality measure, which we were not successful in doing, we were accused of cutting nursing homes. And I just wanted to ask kind of what the status of that quality measure is. Is it still in there? Have we adjusted it at all? Is there any new quality? Because let's face it, quality of nursing homes is a big, big deal, especially with nursing home shortages. I mean, I am not minimizing how hard it is to run a good facility. It's a tough thing, I'm sure, especially now. But I wonder if you could address that.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Liebling. I think we have Nicole Stuck from the department who can help us briefly.
Welcome to the committee. Thanks for being here. Introduce yourself for the record if you need, and we could open up a full HHS hearing here today. So if we could just be super brief, I would really appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So Nicole Stockard, for the record, with the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the question, Chair Liebling, Representative Liebling. So to answer your question, yes, for a while back, we did, a couple years ago, we attempted to adjust that initial quality indicator that was put into VBR, and since then nothing has adjusted that measure since then. I think that's a really quick answer to that question.
Thank you. Anything further?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for indulging that. And then just briefly, so I guess I would say that is a way in which Chair Noor is, you know, we were accused of trying to cut nursing homes by trying to make sure they were hitting the quality measures and that the quality was set appropriately, and Chair Noor isn't even, you're not doing that. So, you know, I guess I would just leave that there, that you're not, you know, I don't hear that you're cutting nursing homes at all. I didn't consider that a cut at the time. I just consider that an appropriate adjustment. If we can never make any adjustment without calling it a cut, I mean, that puts us in a really difficult situation. But again, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we just heard a little bit ago that oftentimes we use projections for what we think is being spent in the bill and moving forward with that. And yet quite often it is less than what we had projected after the biennium is finished. And so, Mr. Chair, are you concerned about that? Do you believe that the funding that is actually projected to come will actually come in for this particular budget area?
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Petersburg, I think the way the Department of Human Services programs are run, it's more on focused programs, meaning that there's no specific number that we can tie into, but the numbers that are baked in right now, that $853 million is guaranteed to be spent in the long-term care in the nursing home. Likewise, I think I talked about the critical access nursing facility programs. We're increasing that by $1 million each year, so to bring it to $10 million in the next 10 years. Those are small, facilities who need help so that people stay short distance to their homes. And that is an investment that we're doing directly in this bill. Otherwise, the $853 million, it's baked in. I'll give you an example. Someone, a CNA who works in the nursing home, will earn $23 in 2025. While in all the other industries, we've been saying it's only $13. We're trying to bring them up so that we have enough people who are moving into the long-term care industry and we can close in on the shortage on the workforce. But likewise, I think if you look at the numbers, that shows that projection of the investment that we're going to do. And the CNA that I just talked about, someone working in a nursing home, is projected to receive $23 an hour in a nursing facility.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And I'll just ask one more question because obviously Health and Human Services and this portion of it is quite complex, and I've not been involved with reading a lot of their reports and so forth, but you said, I think one of the words you used was baked in, and I know that in almost all budgets there is a baked in growth for reimbursements and stuff that is set in autopilot, and we get federal dollars, and sometimes we use that and include it in actual expenditures. Do we have a net on what new dollars are spent in this 846 or whatever you said it was that is above what would have normally been spent extra this year from the base?
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, members, the $853 million includes some federal funds in it. So this is already, it also includes the state funding combined. So that is the total number for the next 4 years, the 853 for the next 4 years. I think that is the number we have.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I just need a follow up then. So what would be the state portion of that?
Representative North.
Madam Chair, members, I think I can follow up on that and share with you once I get that number from the department.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Noor, I'm just wondering how many nursing homes have closed in the last year and how many are projected to continue to close with the budget as it is?
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, members, I don't have that data in front of me, but I think we can ask the department to send to all the members if there are any closures that have happened in the last few years.
Representative O'Neill.
Well, there certainly are. I mean, there are two just this last month in Representative Keel's district alone. Just in 1 month, 11,000 Minnesotans were turned away So at least from what I've seen on the spreadsheets, it's about $4 million more. And I know you talked about $853 million baked in, and you're trying to raise salaries and things like that. But we're at an absolute crisis. So I'm wondering, I'm really shocked that you don't know off the top of your head, like, how many have closed in the last year and how many are projected to close. It's just like, we are in an absolute crisis for our seniors. And like I said, in 1 month alone, 11,000 seniors were turned away and have no place to go. We talk about homelessness all the time in this committee, in every committee. And why would you want a senior out on the street? Like, what are we doing in this bill to actually keep these nursing homes open, Representative Noor?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think I talked about the challenges that all the long-term care systems are facing. I talked about Dennis, who needed a nursing, who needed a PCA. Unfortunately, he passed away because he could not get somebody to transfer him from his wheelchair to his bed. That's in the PCA area. This is about life and death. There are many people who rely on care to receive from PCA and other places. This is an investment to make sure that we provide those resources across the board. So I talked about the $889 million investment in PCA and CFSS. I talked about $874 million investment in assisted living through the Elderly Wave and other places. The data that we're talking about, that 11,000, does not exist because it's duplicated data. It talks about those who are in assisted living, in nursing homes. We don't have a quantifiable number showing how many people have been turned away. Yes, there are people who cannot find the workers, and that creates a problem in all the industries across the state. We are trying to fix that problem in this bill, and we're doing our best with the resources that we have to ensure that we have a good long-term care in the state of Minnesota.
That's enough for me. Thanks, Madam Chair.
So we have another member who is on the list and is back on the list, which is fine. So we'll do that, and then we'll move to final close on the bill. Representative Novotny.
Thank you for the second question, Chair. Representative Noor, it'll be a really short question. I know at the start of session you met with some of the nursing home groups and discussed trying to shorten up the time from billing to actual reimbursement. I know the state of Minnesota is, out of the five surrounding states, the longest in time it takes for the reimbursement, with the modern computer age of reimbursements and data entry. Why is it taking, on average, I'm told, 18 months? And is there any way we can shorten that up? I know that was part of the discussion and the request at the start of session, that there would be a several million-dollar cost to catch up to shorten that period, but why does it take that long for a nursing home to get reimbursed, especially at a time when costs are going up exponentially for energy, food, and things like that?
Looks like Ms. Stockard can answer that. Oh, Ms.
Stockard. Yes, thank you so much for the question. So Nicole Stockard again. Minnesota is very unique in having a value-based reimbursement system, meaning that most states do not have a system where what you put in comes back out on the other side, and that's kind of what we're saying when we talked about getting baked into the rates, meaning expenses that are expended eventually come back and are reimbursed. And so essentially there's not many other states that really we could compare to in that sense. The gap that exists between when the expenses are incurred and when that comes through in the reimbursement, my understanding was that that was intentional from the legislature at the time when VBR was passed. I can definitely state that I think it's fair to say that VBR did not contemplate a pandemic. And so I think that the gap probably has felt a little exacerbated with, you know, recent inflation, but it was an intentional gap at the time that VBR was passed.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair.
Seeing no further discussion, unless Lee Garofalo. Okay, seeing no further discussion, I will go to Representative Noor to close out his bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. As I noted at the beginning, this is an amazing bill. This is a generational investment. This is a historic investment in long-term care. Members, we're taking care of the most vulnerable members in our society by investing in home and community-based services. We're investing in reduction of harm. In this bill, we're also transitioning DCT from the Department of Human Services. I would like to ask everyone, because this is for those who we love the most. This is for everybody. So I will ask you all to say aye to this bill, because we're taking care of Minnesotans who need the help. So thank you so much, Madam Chair members.
Thank you, Representative Knorr, for all your work on this important bill and bringing this forward. So Representative Knorr renews his motion that Senate File 2934, as amended, be placed on the General Register, and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make technical changes as necessary. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails, and Senate File 2934, as amended, has been placed on the General Register. Thank you, Representative Knorr. So the next bill on the agenda for today is House File 1580, Representative Becker Finn, which is the Judiciary and Civil Law Budget Bill. And I will move on behalf of Chair Becker Finn, will move that House File 1580. No, I'm going to move it because it's been a late over. I'm going to move that House File 1580 be before the committee.
All right. Thank you, Chair Olson.
And you don't have any amendments. You're just ready to plot.
We are, other than all the people's seats that are making noises as people. I don't know why they're not sticking around. This is the best one.
Human service is the best.
Look, see how skinny it is? You guys got to love this. Since we're Ways and Means, good morning, members. This is the House Judiciary Omnibus Finance Bill. Part of the reason it's skinny is that the Senate preferred that we have separate finance and policy bills, so this is just our finance provisions. My target was 230 in the first biennium and 260 in the tails. This bill meets those numbers. Quite simply, our bill funds our justice system, the courts, public defenders, civil legal services, and guardians ad litem, in addition to funding the Department of Human Rights. I know that people often joke negatively about lawyers, but the reality is that every single person in this room has someone they care about who has needed the assistance of a public defender or a legal aid attorney at some point in their life. As things stand, our public defense system is at a breaking point, and more than half of the people who qualify and are seeking the assistance of legal aid need to be turned away because we simply are not putting the resources into making sure that we are funding legal aid. This is unequal access to justice for folks who do not have the financial means, and frankly, that should be unacceptable to all of us. The bill also includes eliminating the fees on access to uncertified court documents. That was something that was sort of highlighted during the pandemic as things became available online. Bipartisan agreement on that, and happy to include that this year. Also increases jury pay. Currently, if you have not been called to serve on a jury, you might not be aware, you are only paid $20 per day. As a jury in the state of Minnesota, we are increasing that to $50, which is still a very small amount, especially if you have child care and are taking time away from other paid work. But we did think that was important to take a step in the right direction. Finally, this bill also establishes an Office of Appellate Counsel and Training to make sure that low-income parents in child protection cases also have access to attorneys, as well as needed increases for the courts, including a backlog due to COVID. And with that, Madam Chair, that's the bill, and happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative Becker Finn. Discussion to the bill. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to legal aid, what kind of growth did that budget do this year, and is that sufficient for the needs? Because I know some of the court backlog is because of lack of public defense as well.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you for the question. So it is a significant increase. You know, you can kind of run the numbers and see, you know, if there were enough attorneys sitting around looking for work and you could just magically make there be twice as many attorneys who are ready to take those jobs. This was sort of the question we asked, is what would it take to fully fund this system? Because right now we're turning over half the people. What would it take? So this we do sort of incrementally over time to sort of give time to ramp up to both pay the folks who are doing the work a little bit more so that they can continue doing that work, as well as hiring more attorneys so that we can meet that backlog. So sort of both things on both the legal aid and public defense side.
Thank you. So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, as an incremental percentage, this bill here where would it put it? Would it put it at 75% full funding, 60%? What would your best guess?
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you. You know, I think it's if you got to think about it more as a sliding scale. So it's, you know, in any given year, this was the best that we could do given our target. But I think also in terms of legal aid, if we go too far above what's in this bill, I don't know that they would be able to find the people to do the work. And that's sort of the pickle that we're in. I think this, it speaks to, honestly, decades of underfunding of this system. And with the budget that we have, we're able to start making those long-term investments so that long-term we can start getting us to a point where it truly is fully funded.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see a 56% increase in the Human Rights Department. Now, I've served many years, not currently, but on Judiciary Public Safety, and I cannot think of a reason why we would need 27 new FTEs. Can you explain what the total amount in dollars is that we're increasing and what the 27 new FTEs are needed for in the Human Rights Department?
Thank you. You know, I think this, again, speaks to chronic underfunding of the Department of Human Rights. I know in previous years, in my years here, you know, that often is sort of the last priority for folks when we fund things. So part of it is making sure that we're actually enforcing the laws that we have. I know we talk about that a lot in the judiciary and public safety space, but right now they simply aren't able to investigate and enforce our human rights laws as it is. There also have been efforts around source of income discrimination, as we discussed last night, as well as data gathering around incidents of bias and hate that happen in our communities. So this would address all of those things.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the last statement that you said really kind of struck me. So investigating bias. I mean, I know that the human rights statute is incredibly heavy-handed, particularly against businesses that don't follow the letter of the law. It's expansive. There's a lot of power within the Human Rights Department. Many legislators, at least on my side, are very hesitant to add more power to the Human Rights Department. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, like, do they have a huge backlog of cases or issues? What is it that we're trying to solve here? Is there just a massive backlog that I don't know about?
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you. And I do want to clarify something. The additional funding for enforcement is separate from the data gathering about incidents of bias. The enforcement is actual violations of our human rights laws and our civil rights laws and making sure that we have the tools so that people's civil rights are not being violated in our state. And what we've heard over the years and in our committee is that they simply don't have the resources. You know, it's got to be a really egregious high-level event for them to be able to have the resources to do that. We think that everybody's civil rights and human rights should be protected, and that's part of that enforcement piece. The discrimination and hate data gathering is so we can – that's a separate issue that is different from enforcement, because there's a difference between sort of trying to figure out what is happening in our communities, whether it's hate, you know, incidents of bias of hate, whether it's, you know, swastikas spray painted on public buildings, or, you know, folks being treated differently because of their race, their gender, their ethnicity, you know, sort of getting our arms around what is actually happening in our communities so we can keep people safe, which is separate from the enforcement piece, which is actual violations of the law, which are not being enforced because we don't have the resources put into that at this time.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now I'm just more confused. So can you tell me how many FTEs are going to be doing this data gathering, and for what purpose are we gathering this data? What's the end goal? And two, how many are actually for enforcement of the human rights statutes, which I know, again, are very heavy-handed?
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if you look on your spreadsheet on additional FTE, the enforcement are 16 FTEs. The discrimination and hate data gathering is 2 FTEs. This was really the discrimination and hate data gathering is came from efforts from the community. That is what we heard from the community was that they didn't feel like enough was being done. They didn't feel like they were being heard, that, you know, their elected officials were properly responding to things in the community, you know, whether it was at the beginning of COVID. You know, certainly our Asian American neighbors and community members were experiencing things that maybe some of us who don't appear that way did not experience. So, you know, that's been a large scale community effort, Jewish Community Action. Many other groups have been working on that for a very long time. Chair Hornstein carried it at one time. I've worked on it in the past, and Chair Vang, it was her bill this year. So that's where that is coming from. It is led by community, and we're honoring the perspective and requests of the community.
Representative O'Neill. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, but you didn't really say what the end goal is. So what is the end goal of government surveillance of people? And I don't know if it's social media or, like you said, graffiti or... So you've got two new FTEs to surveil the community to look for discrimination and hate, but they're not doing enforcement of the human rights statutes, the laws. They're not enforcing laws. That's 16 additional people to enforce laws, but two to literally just surveil the community, as you say. To what end? What is the goal?
Representative Becker. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not money for surveillance. It is so that we have, it's two FTEs. That's not a lot of people. The idea is that if, like, let's say, for instance, you're a Hmong elder in our community, and somebody throws something at you or says something really negative to you about COVID or somehow you being responsible for the China virus or any of the other awful things that people have said to each other. And the idea with this is that you would also be able to work with a community organization where you feel safe and they can help you make that report that that's happening. I think we should all be aware of hateful things that are happening in our communities, because the reality is that those incidents often lead to violence. So the sooner we know about what is happening in the community, maybe we can prevent some of the worst case scenarios from happening by knowing. I think we should all want to know if our Jewish friends and neighbors are experiencing things, if our, you know, whatever protected class you are under our human rights statute. We should want to know what's happening in our community so we can address it. And there's no way for us to meaningfully address it if we don't know that it's happening. And that's what this bill does.
Representative O'Neill. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I call it surveillance. You can call it whatever you want. I mean, it's you're gathering data on what people have said to each other, graffiti on a wall. None of these things, because it would be an enforcement if it actually was a violation of the law, or if it was actually an assault, that would go to the police. So I still don't understand what these two people are going to be doing other than surveilling the community to look for things that they could report to, that they actually broke the law and could report to the enforcement side, or that broke the law and was a criminal act, like an assault. They could report that to police. I really don't understand what this is supposed to do. I don't know. To me, it just sounds like government surveillance. I'm kind of done. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill, Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, for this bill. While Rep. Fang is the person that's carrying this bill, the community worked on this bill. This bill has been around for many years. For some of us who come from communities that are targeted all the time, it is really hard for people to know who to report to, where to seek help, who can they talk to. You go to the police, and if it's not criminal enough, the police won't do anything. I remember, you know, a few years ago, when the mosque in Bloomington was bombed, the community was really, really at edge. People were afraid to even go to the most sacred spaces to pray and to be close to God. So this is a bill that is not surveillance. This is a bill that the community worked on. And then we have seen what happened with the Asian community after COVID. So it's always an event that happens that ignites hate, that people feel like that they have every right to go on and, you know, terrorize people, harass people, just spread hate. And then when people, you know, who are on the receiving end of that don't know where to go and who to report and who to talk to, it's really scary. It's scary having conversation with a 60 or 70-year-old man who all he wants to go do is go to the mosque and pray, but he's afraid that something may happen to him along the way. There were people that were attacked going to the mosque at 5 a.m. in the morning. Muslims pray at 5 a.m. in the morning and go to their mosque. So this is a good bill. I know that, you know, the Muslim community, the Jewish community, and many others have worked on this bill because there is a lot of hate towards protected class in this country. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to read a bit from the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which is in law, the Human Rights Act protects Minnesotans in employment. That's a huge area because of race, color, creed, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, disability, status with regard to public assistance, sexual orientation, familial status, and age. It also talks about protecting people from discrimination in areas of housing, in public accommodations, in public services, in education. It notes that such discrimination threatens the rights and privileges of the inhabitants of this state and menaces the institutions and foundations of democracy. This is in statute. You know, we don't always have policy statements in statute, but this is one area where we as a legislature have decided it's important enough that we should actually state the policy of the state. And it goes on to say that it's the policy of the state to protect all persons from wholly unfounded charges of discrimination. Nothing shall be interpreted as restricting the implementation of positive action programs to combat discrimination. You know, it's protection from discrimination is a civil right, and those civil rights are only as good as they are enforced. So I'm really happy that you're making this investment in protecting Minnesotans from discrimination and giving them the means to enforce their rights that are spelled out so clearly in statute. So I'm really excited to be able to support this, and thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, for working on this really important bill.
Further discussion? Lead Grapple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the author, on line 125 of the spreadsheet, can you just describe what that is?
Representative Becker-Finn.
Yeah, thank you. So the First Witness Child Advocacy Center is a center in Duluth that does really incredible work around children who are impacted by violence and involved in court cases. They have a, you know, the reality is, you know, if you imagine you're a 5-year-old child who has witnessed or been the victim of abuse and you walk into a courtroom or even some of the rooms like this, First Witness Child Advocacy Center is a place that is physically designed to be not intimidating for kids so that we can fully make sure that we're not re-traumatizing them when they're involved in legal matters. And First Witness Child Advocacy is in located in northern Minnesota and Duluth. It serves all of the northeastern region of the state. And this was an ask to help them to improve their building so that they can continue and improve on those services to children in the northern part of the state. And I thought it was really good and wanted to make sure we got it done this year. And so it's here on line 125.
Thank you. And to the author, so we're demolishing an existing building?
Representative Becker-Finn.
I honestly, I don't think so, Madam Chair. It's improvements to a building. I don't have that specific language right in front of me.
Madam Chair, and to the author, thank you. On page 5, line 11, it says, this appropriation includes money for demolition of the building located on 1412 East 2nd Street and construction of a parking lot, and for renovation, furnishing, and equipping of buildings at 1402 and 1406. So it does include demolition of the 1412 building?
Representative Becker-Finn.
Yes, Madam Chair, I guess it does.
Okay. Representative Grapple.
And Madam Chair, I think some previous members brought this up, the concern on line 105, the discrimination and hate data gathering. Is this in response to inquiries from the public, or is this proactive, using Representative O'Neill's word, surveillance? Is this in response, or is this initiating data gathering?
Representative Beckerson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that that's an either-or proposition. It is not intended as surveillance. This is, as Chair Hassan noted, this has been an ongoing effort from multiple community organizations and people in the community asking that we better fund things within the Department of Human Rights so that we can get a better handle on what is happening in our communities. It is probably the most community-led thing, constituents, community member-led thing in this entire bill. And again, it's been years of work by Chair Hornstein, Chair Vang, and many, many, many people in our community to improve this.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. There's not a requirement that it be in response to an inquiry from the public. Staff has the ability to, or they would have a responsibility to go out and initiate and search for these items.
Representative
Beckerson. Chair Olson, I mean, that's not delineated. The discussion on the record in committee was to help facilitate people reporting things that are happening. The idea is not that we're, like, making these officers driving around looking for racist things spray-painted on buildings. That's not what this is. This is, if we're going to have encouraging and helping the community report actual things that are happening, they're happening whether we know about it or not. We all as elected officials should want to know about it. But if we don't, they don't have the staff to facilitate those incoming reports and to figure out how to report that data, there's really no point. I mean, the idea is to facilitate community members telling us about incidents of bias that are happening in all of our communities.
Representative Grapple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it is in response then to complaints that are brought in. It's not, being back to my original question, this is in response to items that are brought to the Human Rights Commission.
Representative Beckerton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is, I guess, I'm not sure if you could clarify what you mean by in response, the actions that will be taken if we fund this, or the language of the bill as it is being in response to something. That's what I'm having trouble following about your question.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. So we're adding two new employees on line 105. And my initial question was, is this support personnel in response to people who are coming in and saying, I'm seeing this problem, I'm a victim of this, and as part of that, you have this data gathering? Or is it that this staff will be proactively going out and searching for these items? Is it in response to citizens coming in and filing a complaint, providing information? Or is it sort of to the discretion of these new employees to be looking for these items?
Representative Beckerton.
It's. Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill itself is in response to community coming to us, and the work of the employees would be in response to community members coming to us.
Okay. Representative Brown.
Thank you. So it's not proactive, and it's not like people come into the office and say, let's go try to find some stuff that people are doing wrong today.
Representative Beckerton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, as I said, it's not like these, like, no. It's so that when people report things, they have somebody to report to that can then make sense of the data that's coming in. If I call and leave a voicemail and there's nobody there to answer the voicemail or do anything with the contents of the voicemail, that's not helping anybody. This is to make sure there's somebody there to answer the phone and help folks.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. So line 105, that appropriation is flat in the tails, but the line 102, the one with the 16 new employees, that grows by 33% in the tails. Why is there so much of an increase in the tails for that appropriation?
Representative Beckerton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Similar to the actual larger amounts we're spending in this bill around public defense and civil legal services, there just needs to be time to ramp up. To make sure that we've actually got the people and can find the right people to do the work.
Okay.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I see another hand. Representative Abney.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Becker-Finn, recently drove around the University of Minnesota campus and was documenting some of the graffiti on the campus and outside the campus, the surrounding areas. And if you drive around the cities, I think that, yeah, there is a lot of graffiti. And aside from the gang territorial markings of graffiti, there's one particular group by occupation is without question the most highest mentioned in the graffiti, and that particular occupation, I don't know if that fits the classifications of this group, you know, to the point where we've seen murals at some of the high schools that also make not so flattering remarks about a particular profession. So my question for you, Representative Beckerfin, is would these hate messages be investigated? And do I need to mention what the particular profession is?
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your profession is not a protected class.
Representative Navani.
So that's not considered hate by the state?
Representative Beckerfin. And can I just say really quickly, we're going a far fledge from the actual.
I'll be done. I think my point's been made, Chair.
Yeah, the point has been made. Thank you. Representative Beckerfin.
Madam Chair, I do think this is important, and in the work I've done over the years, both in the county attorney's office and the domestic violence world, and working in the courts previously, it's not illegal to be a jerk. It's not illegal to say mean things. However, it is illegal for you to discriminate against somebody in housing or employment or any of their civil rights because of them being a member of a protected class. That's the focus of this bill.
Sorry, I don't normally go after her lead. He went down a line of questioning, Madam Chair, that I can't let go because I'm looking through the bill. It's a very small bill, and I cannot find any language that substantiates your testimony as far as what these two human rights employees will be doing. There's nothing in here that explains that at all. And am I missing that, or I looked through it real quickly, but.
Representative Beckerfin, and we'll do a little bit more of this, but I do believe this is Representative Bang's bill as well, and probably had, or is that correct? No.
Yes, Madam Chair, but I think the important thing is that we put things on the record in committees. I'm sorry that none of you are on my committee so that you were there for all that testimony, but I can assure you that there were full questioning and vetting and testimony on the record about the intent and the goal of this bill.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm well aware how testimony in the committee works. I'm just trying to find, you were so adamant about what these two employees were supposed to be doing, and I don't even see mention of the two employees. And I'm assuming this is like new positions. We haven't done this before. We haven't done this surveillance before. So I, yeah. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I mean, if it would give people peace of mind for us to add some language about, I mean, we don't tend to micromanage every single position that's funded in a finance bill, but we could certainly have conversations with Chair Vang to put those intentions in writing. There's no ulterior motive here. It's what I stated is the goal of the bill.
Representative O'Neill.
Well, yes, I think that's important, especially when we're expanding the jurisdiction of the Human Rights Department to now what looks like to me surveillance. So however the information comes in, you're gathering information about hate and discrimination, putting it in a spreadsheet, into a report. I don't even know what you're doing with it. Gathering it is all it says. But there's no language in the bill to define what that's supposed to be. So I think that's important. Like I said, it's a brand new thing that the Department of Human Rights will now be doing that they've never done before. So I think, yes, it does merit some words and parameters in the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I wanted to represent O'Neill, and I think more conversation can happen offline about this, too. Seeing no further discussion, I'm going to Representative Becker Finn for final words on your bill. And you have a lot in your bill. It's always interesting where we all hone in. but Representative Becker Finn.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the bulk of our discussion was about two FTEs. Most importantly, as I said at the beginning, this bill is really about transformational change to our justice system so that people with lower incomes have the same access to justice that everybody else does. That is the heart of this bill. That is the bulk of this bill. That is where the vast majority of the funding in this bill goes to our public defense system, our civil legal aid system, so that no matter where you live in the state, no matter how much money you make, you have access to justice. Justice for all, that's something we say every single day when we do the pledge on the House floor, and that is the heart of this bill and what our focus has been and will be going forward. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the discussion and your support.
Thank you, Representative Becker Finn. And with that, House File 1580 is laid over. And the next bill on our agenda for today is Senate File 2909, Representative Moeller, the Public Safety Budget Bill. And so Representative Moeller moves that Senate File 2909 be placed on the General Register. I'll also make a motion on your behalf, Representative Moeller, that Representative Moeller moves to delete everything after the enacting clause and insert the language from House File 2890, the first engrossment. Discussion to the motion. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say nay.
No.
The motion prevails and the language has been adopted.
Did you say first engrossment or second?
I said the first engrossment. Yep. So that has been adopted. So the House file language has been adopted into the Senate file in front of us. And you have an author's amendment as well, Representative Moeller, the A24. So would you like to move your A24 amendment?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Wonderful. Could you describe your A24 amendment, please, Representative Moeller?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A24 makes mostly technical changes. Several were at the request of the Department of Public Safety. The ones that are less technical that I want to highlight for you are two items that we inadvertently didn't fund but that are important. That first is the Human Trafficking Task Force, and another one was the Redemption Project, which was a bipartisan bill. We also needed to make some adjustments in light of the updated fiscal note that we received after we worked on some amendments to the fentanyl bill. I worked closely with Representative Baker on his fentanyl bill. We made some changes in committee, and we got an updated fiscal note that we wanted to make sure that we reflected those numbers in this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. Discussion to the amendment. Any discussion there? Okay, seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the A24, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A24 amendment is adopted. We also have the A23 grant management amendment. So Representative Moeller moves the A23 amendment. Any discussion to that?
Madam Chair, can I just make a note too for folks that we did adopt the changes that were made by this committee with the Education Finance Bill at lines 2.14. So just wanted to make sure that this is updated version of the amendment we've been passing. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. I apologize for not going to you on that. So all those in favor of the A23 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A23 amendment is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Well, as Chair Noor said, today is a good day. I'm really excited about this public safety bill as well. This bill is a transformational bill for our state's public safety system, and it is a balanced bill. For those of you who aren't on the committee or don't know, the House Public Safety Finance Bill funds several state agencies, including the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Corrections, the Post Board, the Private Detective Board, and the Ombudsperson for Corrections. In addition to funding our state agencies, this bill funds critical investments in public safety initiatives brought forward by members of the House. Those are things like violence prevention and modernizing our criminal statutes. The target we had for this bill was $650 million in the next biennium. And I'm just going to touch on some of the highlights for this committee of what we've used that target money for. victim services here. We have money for victim services across the state. Unfortunately, there's a federal shortfall that's coming that helps fund that, so we cover that gap. We have the state paying for sexual assault exams now and an increase in turnaround times for the processing of sexual exam kits. We established the new Missing and Murdered Black Women and Girls Office, and we have funding for domestic violence and sexual assault housing grants. This bill funds law enforcement, particularly some of the initiatives within the BCA, helping local jurisdictions responding to crime. We heard when we talked to law enforcement groups at the beginning of session that recruitment was probably their number one concern. We worked on that. Representative Hewitt had a great bill, so we fund that. We work on mental health crisis that's for our first responders, making sure that they have the resources that they need to do the job well. We also fund mental health response co-responder teams so that we have the right people responding to situations in our communities. This bill makes transformational changes to our probation system. This is something that the counties and DOC have been working on for years, and Representative Vice Chair Feist has worked really hard on this issue, and I'm really excited that we can move forward with this proposal this year. We also have other things that help people who are to get rehabilitated. We have Alternatives to Incarceration Program. It's a Representative Mueller bill out of Maurer County. We have investments in education and employment opportunities for people to help them get back on their feet again and reduce recidivism. We have accountability in this bill. We fund additional positions at the Post Board to conduct investigations and the Private Detectives Board. This bill also creates a state fraud unit in the BCA to investigate instances of fraud. And then we address current crimes. We have, like I mentioned previously with the amendment, worked very carefully with Representative Baker on our fentanyl bill to recognize the crisis that we're dealing with statewide when it comes to fentanyl, and really trying to get at those who are selling and dealing fentanyl. We have a new crime of organized retail theft. We deal with closing some loopholes related to domestic violence cases. We have common sense gun safety legislation in this bill. We have juvenile reform, which we talked about in committee, how our juvenile system is a broken system, and we start to try to fix that system with this bill. We have several proposals. Again, Vice Chair Feist led on a lot of these efforts. We have youth intervention grants, the Office of Restorative Justice grants. We heard from Yellow Medicine County on the great work they're doing around restorative justice and how not only is it reducing recidivism, it's reducing costs to their county, and that model's starting to be used around the state. So we really want to enhance something that's good that we know is working. And Ramsey County came to us with a great proposal regarding their therapeutic homes and support services, and I know Representative O'Neill has worked on that initiative as well. We have a violence prevention investment in this case. This is something that Representative Frazier has worked really hard on to make sure that we are looking at violence prevention. That is so important. We know that there are many organizations that are doing good work, and this would allow both local communities or nonprofits with local community support to apply for these grants. And we also have funding in this bill for local emergency management. So those are just some of the highlights, Madam Chair and members, and I am happy to hear your questions and answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Discussion to the bill. Representative Devotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Mueller, a lot of new FTEs in this bill. And been looking through various notes and haven't got a hard number on the FTEs we're creating. How many would you say we have in this bill?
So thank you, Madam Chair. So we have 252 FTEs, and you can see that on line 347, I believe.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. And another question for you, Representative Mueller, Chair Mueller. I know it's been a moving number with the reimbursement to the counties for the probation, and it seems like I get a new update on where that's going. Can you fill us in on where we're at for that funding and percentage?
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lead Novotny, for that question. Yes, we are still working on that. There was an initial mistake that was made in the calculations, and so we're working through that right now. But that is a high priority to get that right. It is so important to all of our counties, and they've worked for a couple of years on this proposal and getting that right. So I know that that is a priority for us. It's a priority for the Senate and for the governor as well.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Representative Moeller, do we have, I mean, it's, we're coming up to kill line or the deadline. With any, is there anything I can help with? Or it's something that, as you said, it's very critical, and I did work on the governor's task force that was set up to study this. So anything I can do to help, please let me know, because I think it is very important that we get that taken care of.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lee Novotny. I didn't realize you were on that task force, so I'd be glad to talk further about you with you about what's going on. And I know Vice Chair Feist is remaining very close with the discussions and the actual numbers that are being floated. So let's keep in touch on that. Thank you.
Further discussion to the bill. Lee Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Line 53 of the budget sheet, what is that?
Representative Moeller.
Are you referring to House File 14, the Pinto gun purchase background check?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Garofalo. So the funding that is affiliated with that, that is the criminal background check bill, and I believe it relates to some department costs for computer systems, IT, that sort of thing.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author, but we already do background checks.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Lead Garofalo. We don't do background checks on all transfers of guns. Right now, the background checks are only required for federally licensed dealers, so the private transfers don't have the background check requirement, and that's what this bill does. Of course, there are a number of exceptions for transfers that still wouldn't apply. We're talking about background checks for pistols and military semi-automatic military-style assault weapons here, so some of the hunting rifles will be excluded. But for background checks for those types of firearms, we don't have background checks for private transfers for those firearms.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, when we transfer private property from one individual to another, I understand that. But doesn't it just strike you as odd as $70,000? Like, it seems like something as expansive as that. Do you recall? I don't have the fiscal note in front of me. Do you recall what the fiscal note was? What their added costs were? The $70,000. It would seem to me like that would be either it seems unusually small for what is being proposed.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't recall the specifics other than it being computer IT related.
Yeah. Representative Graffel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Us computer guys do that stuff. And then the total number of FTEs that are being added, what was that number again?
Representative Moeller, and it is on our spreadsheet too. I know both the judiciary and this spreadsheet had the FTEs there, which I think has been helpful. So, Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The total number of FTEs being added is 252. I would note that there are currently, from my understanding for these agencies, about 6,400 total FTEs, so this would be an additional 252, which ends up being about a 3.9% increase.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And of those, how many of those would be licensed officers or individuals who are licensed?
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So our committee doesn't fund local law enforcement. We wouldn't fund that. And then as far as the state patrol, that is not within the jurisdiction of our committee. That's a transportation committee that funds the state patrol.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, so for example, line 40, the use of force investigations unit, that's adding 23 FTEs. None of those would be licensed officers?
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I mean, I certainly, I suppose you could have licensed officers in these positions, but I was understanding your question is like thinking about officers in a different way than that. But so, for example, that use of force investigations unit, they look at both use of force, deadly force encounters with law enforcement, and also sexual assaults that are allegedly committed by law enforcement and sexual assaults between and by members of the National Guard. That's scheduled to sunset, so there's ongoing funding for that. Certainly, those investigators probably are licensed police officers, but not in the traditional sense that I thought you were asking about originally.
Representative
Brock. Madam Chair, I apologize for not asking a more specific question. And then the next one below that, line 41, the violent crime reduction strategy. There's 51 FTEs. This isn't like the violence interrupters stuff that people are mocking, is it? That's not that, is it?
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Lee Novotny. So the 51 is actually.
Novotny, I'm Groff.
Or sorry, Representative Groff.
All the times I said Moeller.
She's just to her own committee.
I am right.
Representative Groffalo. Where are we at?
Thank you. Sorry, I got everybody all confused. Representative Grofflo, so the 51 FTEs that you're looking at there is in the governor's recommendation. It's not in ours. What we did was in House File 25, Representative Frazier's bill, we created a special revenue account to fund the BCA to help local law enforcement with investigating crimes and going to those areas where there's an increase in crime. And so that, like I said, is created differently in our bill than in the governor's proposal.
Representative Groffel.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, and there's no new revenue in your bill, right, in terms of no assessments, fees, tax increases?
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Groffel, there is a fire surcharge. We went back to what I think was changed in 2012, I want to say, with the fire. There's an assessment for, in order to help fund training for our firefighters. I think it goes from 0.5% to 0.65%. We're just going back to language from years ago. So I just want to make sure that you're aware of that.
Representative
Brock. Where in the spreadsheet is that? I guess I must have missed it.
And we can maybe have, do you want nonpartisan fiscal staff?
Please, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Wonderful. So we'll take a minute here just to get settled. Do you have any more questions while we get the...
That's not true, thank you.
Okay. We'll go to that.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is John Walls, House Fiscal Staff. I'm looking to find the line number I believe the provision to raise the surcharge on home insurance premiums raises $5.1 million, and that is on line 361 of the spreadsheet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just missed it. Thank you, Mr. Walsh.
Representative O'Neill.
It's a bad day, Madam Chair. I don't normally go after our lead, but something else just occurred to me. I'm very sorry. So the Fugitive Apprehension Unit, we're adding 11, and they have a very narrow scope of what they're supposed to be doing. And I'm just wondering if you could explain what, I mean, I think that's almost doubling it. Last time I checked, it was 13 members, and this is going off my memory from during pandemic, because we had a long conversation about that with the DOC and expanding their authority. Interestingly enough, that conversation happened with the DOC commissioner just prior to the riots. And he was talking about how he wanted them to join forces with State Patrol and the DNR licensed officers to combat uprisings. Or he had mentioned riots before there were riots even happened. It was very interesting. But anyway, in any case, at that point we had 13 officers, and now you're going 11 more. So you're almost doubling it. So what are they for? Because they have a very narrow scope of what they do.
Looks like we have the commissioner here. So welcome, Commissioner Schnell. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Schnell, commissioner at the Department of Corrections, and to Representative O'Neill. You're right, 13. We have currently have 13 sworn officers and that do fugitive apprehension work for the Department of Corrections. Over the course of time, and given the concerns about repeat offending. Ultimately, this addition is intended to address the number of warrants that we have across the state. And certainly, we still will be working with VSETs and with local law enforcement across the state. But ultimately, we want to drive down the number of people and more quickly respond to be able to bring people who are non-compliant and have a warrant issued back into custody.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you happen to know, like, how many outstanding, you know, I don't know if you have any numbers in your head just to help me kind of get a sense as to how many are out there with warrants that are not being apprehended? Like, how many do we have among us, I guess is sort of the question.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, currently we have about 420 warrants that are active issued, and we issue about between 50 and 60 a week.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Schnell, are you meaning, so the 13 sworn officers we have in the Fugitive Apprehension Unit are not able to do that, and there are, so they're just 420 are just somewhere that they don't know where they are. Is that just so if I understand what you're saying correctly?
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, there is an active backlog, which is very comparable to what happens in counties across the state. And certainly there's a lot of duplication and overlap with many of these people who may have warrants in those counties. But yeah, they are actively working. Again, when we're issuing 50 warrants per week, that 13, that unit of 13 is, it focuses on those. We prioritize warrants based upon loss of life cases and level 3 predatory sex offenders are the top priority. Those are the first focus. And then, you know, we work those warrants as we go forward.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Just one other quick follow-up question and then I'll be done. So, you know, we've had, there is a perception, we'll just say, that they're apprehended, they're processed, and then they're back out on the street. That's the perception. It's in the media, it's on social media, it's in mainstream media, it's talk around communities that are being carjacked, the communities that are being, their cars stolen, which is even worse, and so on, so on, so on. So, say you're doing 50 warrants issued a week. Of those that you do apprehend and they do get processed, are you seeing that? Is that true? Is that narrative true, I guess? Are you seeing them just right back out on the streets again to commit whatever they're going to do?
And we'll do, I'll, the commissioner's here and he can answer this, but I think this is getting a little far out of the spreadsheet justification for FTEs, but I, being the commissioner's here, we'll do this. So Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, may I qualify why I'm asking that?
Representative O'Neill, yes, please.
Because I always ask for a reason. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the reason I'm asking is if you apprehend somebody and you process them through the courts and they go right back out and commit another felony or whatever they're doing, then another warrant needs to be issued because now they have violated the conditions of their probation yet again. And so I'm wondering, like, how many of those are recycled through or how many of them are new? I guess that's a better way to explain that. So the narrative means that they're not being held long enough to really make a difference in crime. And if we're apprehending the same ones over and over again, so that's kind of the question.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think, you know, we're talking about almost two separate groups of warrants here. There can be some overlap, certainly. This unit really focuses extensively on those people who have been in prison and were subject to release. So these are Department of Corrections warrants. And certainly county warrants, the district courts issue many, many, many warrants, which the sheriffs, you know, work on focusing on bringing those people into custody along with local law enforcement. But certainly, you know, we work together on these cases. In these particular cases, it is the hearings and release unit of the Department of Corrections that with those people are held. They have a right to a hearing. That hearing has to happen within 12 days. And those hearings occur, and a decision is made in conjunction with the probation officers whether these people are going to be restructured or brought back into prison.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This isn't the time or place. I just was trying to understand the justification for literally doubling this apprehension unit and trying to understand, you know, are these kind of just recycled through over and over and over again, or what exactly we're dealing with. So I don't know that we're going to get to that, but I was just trying to understand the justification for an additional, literally just doubling that particular unit.
Further discussion. Thank you, Commissioner. Seeing no further discussion, I will go to Representative Moeller for the last word on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the questions today. I appreciate it. Really, in closing, I just want to say that this public safety bill is about trying to rebuild trust in our public safety system. If we have a system that people don't trust, that means that victims don't report crimes. It means that witnesses don't come forward. It means that juries don't trust experts or others. And it's just so important to have trust in our system in order for our system to work. And that's what this bill gets at. I do want to thank especially my CA, Ellen McDaniel, and I'll do all the thank yous later on the floor. But I just wanted to give a special shout out to her and to nonpartisan staff, to Lead Novotny, and to your researcher, John Holquist, as well, and our researcher, Zach. So with that, Madam Chair and members, I look forward to your support with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. And I think we're always willing to do more than one shout-out for staff. So, glad you could do it here today, too. So now we'll go into the process of merging the bills. If you just stay right there, we'll go through all these procedural motions. So now what we'll do is start with the judiciary and civil law motion. So Representative Becker-Finn, would you move that the language contained in House File 1580 be incorporated into the public safety, judiciary, and civil law budget bill as separate articles?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and the articles have been adopted. So the next merger here is Representative Moeller. Would you move that the language in Senate File 2909, as amended, be incorporated into the Public Safety, Judiciary, and Civil Law Budget Bill as separate articles?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
So we have the motion now where we have the merger has happened, so now we're voting on final passage of the merged bill. So Representative Moeller renews her motion that Senate File 2909, as amended, be placed on the General Register and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make technical changes as necessary. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and Senate File 2909, as amended, has been placed on the General Register. Thank you, Representative Moeller. So with that, we have a committee meeting tomorrow at 9 and then again on Monday at 9, and then that will probably be it for a while. So we're going to hang tough for a few more days. This committee is the only game in town, I think, for the next few days. So I really appreciate everyone being here so we can start on time and just digging in. And I appreciate all the thoughtful questions. And with that, we do not have anything more on the docket. And Ginny's waving at me, so
yeah,
I'm going
to make
sure
we said the right bill number. We did say the right bill number. I maybe heard wrong. I just want to make sure we had the right bill.
So just to be clear, we had to merge the Senate files, the House files. Okay. We got there. Staff has made sure I am not screwing this up.
Perfect.
So,
awesome.
Yep, we're good. So with that, there's nothing more on the agenda, and we are adjourned.